Greetings once again, America. My name is Doug McBurney, and you may have heard the news, but stand by now for the Worldview. That's right. It is the Weekly Worldview, and I'm so glad to have you back on the show where we don't take calls. We don't tolerate sponsors, but we do focus on the events of the week through the lens of original thought. And it's cold and dark here in Denver, and we're ready to start the show. And I was trying to think if there was anything interesting that happened in my life this week that I could regale you with. And I can't really think of anything. Yeah, Kentucky. It rained in Kentucky the whole time. I may bring up an incident from Kentucky later in the broadcast, but for now we want to jump right into the news. No, before we jump into the news, we want to say to Ken and Joe Scott, that our prayers are with you. Passing of a family member, Scotty, and great sermon this morning at Denver Bible Church talking about what happens to you the moment after you die. And just for all you heathens and atheists out there, it ain't annihilation, so don't relax, all right? You should be nervous. You should be very nervous. Anyway, an excellent sermon. And our prayers go out to Ken and Joe. And we'll say hi to Scotty. He's looking down at us now, which is pretty cool. Think about that. And now to jump into the news of the week. This is something that'll depress Scotty for sure. It's from the Science Really file, as opposed to the Science Really file that we quite often go into. This is real science. This is from the BBC, and they report that young men in America are participating more and more in a dialect called uptalk, or Valley Girl speak. And they say that in the past, this type of talk... And you all know what it is, right? You all, like, know what it is, right? In the past, this has been associated with young females, typically from Southern California, hence the title Valley Girl Speak. But now, a research team says that this way of speaking is becoming more frequent among men. The findings were presented at the meeting of the Annual Society of America. I'm sorry, the Acoustical Society of America in California. The annual? Yeah, that wouldn't have made any. The acoustic. These are people who study acoustics. And somebody's got to do it. I've always been a fan of acoustics myself. Although Valley Girls Speak, I've never been a big fan. They report, they say, quote, "We found the use of uptalk in all of our speakers, despite their diverse backgrounds in socioeconomic status, ethnicity, bilingualism, and gender," said a linguist at the University of California who led the research. So they're all talking that way no matter where they're from, no matter what gender they are. That means it doesn't matter if it's a boy or a girl, if you're even allowed to classify people as boy or girl anymore, and it seems these researchers think that they are. That they seem to think that it's okay to classify people as boys or girls or males or females. So that little bit is encouraging anyway. They say, "We believe that uptalk is becoming more prevalent and systematic in its use for the younger generations in Southern California and elsewhere." The BBC reports that people who speak uptalk are often misunderstood to be insecure, shallow, or slightly dim.
Wait. BBC?
The BBC says that.
British talks like that.
Well, no, they speak with a British accent. It's quite a different thing.
They use the like.
I don't think they say like very much, except when they're trying to compare two things. One thing could be like another, but they're never going to say, this one is like, you know, that one, you know? I don't think, although that's a possibility. I guess it takes someone from the outside to analyze American linguistic patterns. And so the BBC and the Acoustic Society of America... The BBC reports on the Acoustic Society of America because American newspapers tend to shy away from reporting anything that's actually news anymore. They say, oh yeah, people are, if you speak like a valley girl, they say you may be perceived as insecure, shallow, or slightly dim, but they say that's not necessarily the case. Not necessarily the case. which means almost every time it in fact is the case, but not necessarily the case. Now they say finding out where it started is very difficult. One possibility is that this is an extension of a pitch pattern that we find in most varieties of English. When you're making a statement, but you're also asking indirectly for the interlocutor to confirm if they are with you. Now, that's kind of hard to follow. That means you're making a statement, but simultaneously, you're asking the question, do you understand what I'm talking about? And so you have to have a little lilt, I guess, at the end of your, like, voice or your statement so that it's like a question. Was my statement like a question? Anyway, I've got to say, I think that it's simply the fact that we're in a world where everyone is increasingly unsure of what is actually true and increasingly unsure if others understand what the truth is. So I suppose this is a predictable linguistic trend as we are unmoored further and further from the truth and nobody really knows what's going on anymore. And so we tend to question what's happening. I don't know if it's true. Where did I come from? Where am I, like, going? Do you know where you're, like, going? All right. So that's pretty depressing. It's more of the, what is Limbaugh calls it, the chickification of America. I think it's more the feminization of America and the language and everything else. And speaking of being unmoored from the truth and being generally confused, we'll go to Samir Chopra at his website, samirchopra.com. I have no idea who this person is. He showed up. Well, I assume it's a he. Perhaps that's sexist of me. Samir? Any idea on Samir, my dear? No? I have no clue. I think it's a boy, though. His blog is titled The Personhood Beyond the Human Conference. That's what I said. And this was posted on December 7th by Samir Chopra, a date which will live in infamy. Samir says, this weekend, December 7th and 8th, I'm attending the event titled Personhood Beyond the Human Conference at Yale University. Here's a description of the conference's agenda. The event will, like, focus on personhood for non-human animals. And it will explore the evolving notions of personhood by, like, analyzing them through the frameworks of neuroscience, behavioral science, philosophy, ethics, and law. Special consideration will be given to discussions of non-human animal personhood and ways to protect animals' interests through the establishment of legal precedents and by increasing public awareness. Did I start sliding into a homo lisp there? I apologize, Samir, for that. So they're having a conference at Yale University, for crying out loud, on the personhood of non-human animals. First of all, they're classifying humans and animals in the same general lump, which I hate. And they're arguing for the personhood of, well, other than persons, frankly. And I will boldly proclaim, I will posit that Mr. Chopra is in fact an advocate of human abortion, the murder of innocent children, because he will claim, I predict, that they are not persons. And I read his definition of what a person is here. And it's out of there. It's not correct. They're happy to grant personhood, or at least to argue for the personhood of apes and other animals that have eyebrows and can make facial expressions. But a baby in the womb, they don't want to hear any of that. And I guarantee Samir Chopra, whether it's a boy or a girl, and whether he, she, it lisps or not, or speaks like a valley girl, I guarantee you Samir Chopra is an advocate of human abortion. So there, Samir. Sue me. All right. Now, speaking of lisping. Did I say listing? No, that's the good ship America is listing. But Elton John is lisping. Although he doesn't really talk like a homo. Have you noticed that about Elton? He doesn't have the effeminate homo lisp.
I never pay attention to that guy.
Yeah, well, not that I'm not saying I listen to him give a lot of speeches. I'm just saying he doesn't talk like a flaming queer. At least as far as I can recall.
Yeah, but
He's pretty whacked out. Well, listen to this. This is from the French press agency. Elton John used a sold-out Moscow concert to challenge a law banning the propaganda of homosexuality to minors. You know about this law because we've reported it proudly on this show, frankly, that in Russia it's illegal to explain same-sex relationships to children. They've passed a law in Russia making that illegal. And when you have to pass a law like that, you know your society is in trouble. There are certain things that should go unspoken, and they should simply be understood, like you shouldn't talk to minor children about deviant sexual practices. It should just be common knowledge. But when your society is circling and slipping ever so slightly over the rim of hell, you have to pass laws. You know, in Texas, they passed a Merry Christmas law. Have you heard about that? Yeah. Down in Texas, they have a law that you cannot discriminate against people or businesses or places that say Merry Christmas. They passed a law. So you know we're in trouble when you have to pass a law against things that should just be common decency and common knowledge. For example, this law in Russia. It's a shame. But Elton had been urged by some homo advocates to cancel the concerts. But John explained that he felt Russian homos would feel abandoned if he did not come and offer them support. And that's it. There was also like the $8 million he made that night. That was a bit of an issue.
I'm surprised
he was allowed into Russia. Of course he was allowed into Russia. Vladimir Putin's probably a lot like me. He's disgusted by Elton's personal lifestyle choices and advocacy. But, you know, Benny and the Jets? I mean, who wouldn't want to hear that lie?
I don't.
Okay. All right. By the way, Elton performed in a theater popular with Russia's super rich. You know, it probably costs more to get into that Elton John concert than the average Russian factory worker makes in a year. And I think that might be one of the reasons Elton didn't cancel the concerts. This is from, the French press agency. They report that Elton was careful not to criticize Putin directly. Yeah. But he did say, what did he say? He said to the Russians gathered in the super rich theater, he said, "You've always embraced me and you've never judged me. I'm deeply saddened and shocked over the current legislation that is now in place against the community here in Russia." Just the community, he said. Because if he would have said homosexual, Putin probably would have taken a nightstick and arrested him right there off the stage. That would have been something to see. Anyway, we'll move on because my extremely attractive audio engineer hates it. When
I don't like Elton John.
She doesn't like Elton John. All right, first of all. Okay, we understand that. And then the homos in general, I understand. You're just not a fan of hearing about what they're up to. So let's move on to the personhood file here in the United States. New numbers from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reveal that fewer women in the United States are having children. Big shock, right? My first question, why is the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention responsible for accumulating these data on childbirths? I mean, does our government view children as a disease to be prevented? And that's why I just thought that was odd. That struck me as odd that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention present these fairly depressing stats. Between 2000 and 2009, pregnancy rates for U.S. women fell by 12%. But on the bright side, if you want to think of it that way, the rates for teenage pregnancy reached a historic low. There were 39% fewer teen pregnancies than in 1991, and everybody raised their hands and said, yay! Now, according to a researcher from the Guttmacher Institute, she says, research suggests that more teens are delaying initiating sex and waiting longer to have sex. And I would ask her, right. What research suggests that to you? I mean, if you go out amongst the youngsters today, let's say kids between, say, 15 and 20, and you just mingle with them for an afternoon and then come back to me and tell me if you think they're having less sex now than they were in the early 90s. I have a feeling they're not. Although they may be having less heterosexual sex. That could be true. She says, more teens are using more contraceptives and using more effective methods of contraception, says the Guttmacher Institute associate. He's a senior research associate. So she says it's more contraception, better contraception, delaying initiating sex, waiting longer to have sex. I say it's abortion pills, and that's all it is. Well, I suppose you could throw homosexuality into that mix, but probably not as prominent in the reduction in teenage abortions than the abortion pills. Do you want proof? Later from the story, this is from CNN, by the way. Abortion rates overall have also dropped. There were 32% fewer abortions in 2009 than in 1990, and the biggest drop was seen in teen abortions. The rate for teen abortions in 2009 was less than half the rate it was in 1990. And I think that's just the surgical abortion rate, because now we've got the abortion pills. And you know, the young kids, they're always the ones to adopt the more advanced technologies. And so we have fewer women actually having children. We have more people killing their children via chemical abortifacients. And we've got a senior researcher from the Guttmacher Institute trying to bamboozle us about what's going on. And I'm just here to say, I'm not buying any of it. See, I wanted her real bad, and I was about to give in. But as she started talking about true love, started talking about sin. I said, honey, I live with you for the rest of my life. She said, no hugging, no kissing.
Keep your hands to yourself.
It's the Weekly Worldview, and I'm your host, Doug McBurney, along with my extremely attractive audio engineer, bringing you the news of the week that you won't hear on other talk shows, or at least a perspective that you simply won't hear on other talk shows. An unabashedly Christian, heterosexual, theonomist, dispensationalist, young earth creationist. Is there anything I missed? There's something I missed, but that's all right. We'll get to that later. Right now, let's go to the decline and fall of Western civilization, part two. Part one was the birth rate there, as reported on the CNN blog. Part two, a pill, I said, that provides a method of contraception for men has been brought a step closer by mad scientists. Now, they just say scientists, but I would have to say those in charge of researching a method for men to not only choke off the next generation and commit civilizational suicide, but also to just run wild and free and have a reversible form of contraception. That has to be a mad scientist. The Guardian reports that researchers have identified two proteins that can be blocked to prevent the launch of sperm cells. Knocking out the proteins in genetically engineered mice resulted in male animals that were completely infertile, although they continued to mate normally. And there you have, ladies and gentlemen, the liberal and the libertarian dream. They want to be able to mate like rats without any consequences. Yeah. Well, except for the herpes and the HPV and syphilis and gonorrhea. But they're working on that. They got a separate group of mad scientists who are working feverishly to cure all those consequences. They just want these particular libertines that I refer to simply want to get under out from under the responsibility of actually bearing children, but they still want to be able to rut like wild animals. The Guardian reports that a male contraceptive pill has been the holy grail of fertility scientists. I find that disconnected there. I would think that fertility should be the holy grail for fertility scientists. You know, making infertile people fertile. But I guess I've got different priorities than the mad scientists over the fertility scientists who are falling all over themselves to find a pill that we can add to the other contraceptive devices that are just slowly choking off the next generation and causing people to be depressed. Yeah, I think so. I think rutting like a wild animal with anyone and everyone and not having any kids, I think you end up depressed, lonely, old, sick, and then you die. And then guess what? It's not annihilation. You don't just go to sleep. Oh, no. Nope. But I'm not going to tell you what happens because I'd like you to find out for yourself. You could just go over to KGOV.com or DenverBibleChurch.com. Order the sermon from December 8th, 2013, and find out what happens the moment you die. All right? So there you have it. The Decline and Fall of Western Civilization, Part 2 there. And now, from the personhood file, as reported by Salon.com, in New York, four chimpanzees are suing the state for their freedom. I know. How are they're being assisted by lawyers.
Lawyers.
Yeah. They're getting help from humans. They just want to clarify that. Yeah, just in case, you know, if you're a millennial and you're reading this, you might think that the chimps are actually... We have to be clear that they are getting legal help from human lawyers. But they're seeking, these lawyers are seeking for these animals to be recognized as legal persons. Didn't I already do this story? Oh, no, that was the Yale University. Yale is discussing non-human personhood.
Lawyers in New York are suing for non-human personhood.
And meanwhile, those of us who advocate for the personhood of human beings, whether they're born or in the womb or whether they're old and sick and unloved and inconvenient, we're called crazy. We're the ones who are marginalized. But not these lawyers who are arguing on behalf of Mongo and Bongo, the chimps. The lawyer, the particular lawyer involved here, do I have his name here? Stephen Wise, an ironic name for a man arguing for the personhood of animals. But his name is Stephen Wise, and he has a group called the Non-Human Rights Project. Just that alone right there, I mean. How did that make it past the IRS when he applied for his tax-free status? Non-human rights? Anyway, let's move on. This particular lawyer argues that because chimpanzees are autonomous, self-determined, self-aware, intelligent, and emotionally complex beings who cognitively resemble human beings, they must be declared legal persons with rights. Yeah. And I know you think it sounds bizarre, but apparently, according to Salon.com, Spain and New Zealand have already extended personhood rights to great apes. It's already happening in the West. These are not Eastern mystical countries where, you know, they're into religions where Vishnu created everything, Vishnu created nothing, and pretty much anything goes in a religion like that. And in a civilization founded on kind of a nebulous idea of religion and God and life, the universe, everything. But this is Spain and New Zealand, for crying out loud. They've given personhood rights to the great apes. Now, Mr. Wise, the lawyer, he says, our goal is to breach the legal wall that separates humans from all non-human animals. There's that word again, non-human animals. Yeah, the Non-Human Rights Project said that in their own blog post. And they use slavery as a natural comparison to the current situation of captive chimpanzees. See, they're upset that Mongo and Bongo and his sister Boingo, the chimp, that they're being used for medical experiments. And so they want to free and liberate these captive chimpanzees. And their latest strategy is to sue for legal personhood. And I will have to at least hand this to them. They're probably smart to pursue that in court because eventually they probably will win the way things are going. They say our strategy is to file as many suits as we have the funds to pursue and to encourage other animal rights attorneys to file similar cases. Yeah. So there you go. So all of you advocates for personhood out there, I mean for human personhood of humans, well, I'm encouraged that we shouldn't give up. Because if the court will entertain the idea of personhood for chimpanzees, surely at some point they'll consider the personhood of persons. Oh, well, we'll just see about that. Because we're not going to quit either. And we will march, we will continue to march for the legal recognition of the personhood of, well, persons. I know it's not as exotic as, you know, the chimps, but we're trying. Now, reason number 789 to keep or get your children out of the government schools. Salt Lake City, Utah. At least 57 Utah educators have been suspended from teaching or had their licenses revoked for downloading pornography. Yeah, that's according to a review of nearly 400 teacher misconduct cases dating back to 1993. And these cases account for a larger and larger share of sanctions as compared to years past. So teachers are being disciplined at about the same rate, but the discipline for downloading pornography at school, well, that's increasing exponentially. That's a little bit scary. That's reason 789. Now, the Salt Lake Tribune reports that education leaders are debating new rules for regulating teacher misconduct, and opinions differ on whether viewing pornography should be treated as a potential precursor to sexual activity involving students. Opinions differ. Okay, well, let me give you my opinion. Just delete the word potential from that statement. Yeah, viewing pornography should be treated as a precursor to sexual activity involving students. That's all. If you got a teacher downloading pornography at school, I think it's pretty safe to assume that that is a precursor to all kinds of nefarious activities that frankly shouldn't be going on, let alone in the government schools, in the temples of Satan worship. But it really shouldn't be going on anywhere. And pornography should be illegal everywhere. And keep in mind, the tagline for the Weekly Worldview is, in fact, death to pornographers. So I believe I was in Lexington, Kentucky. Got into the hotel late, like 11 o'clock, after driving across Kentucky through the rain and sleet and ice. And I'm checking into my hotel. I go into the lobby, and the attendant is in the back office just outside my view. And she's having quite the argument with her child about coming home late. And I hear her voice elevates, and she's angry, and she admonishes the child, and I ring the little bell. Ding! At which point she has to break it off, slam down the phone, and she comes out, and she can't help it. She's got it. Her eyes are teared up. She's obviously flustered. And I made a comment, like, boy, it sounds like you got your hands full there. And she said, you know, we were homeschooling up until this year. And she said, I never had these kinds of problems before, but now my daughter, she's going out with friends, and she doesn't come home, and now she's making excuses. And I said, well, how old's your daughter? 15. She wanted to go to public high school because she thought that the child talked her parents into putting her into government school because she wanted to make sure she could get into the right college. Now, the families has some hardships. The husband is a war vet. He had to quit work and go get some major surgeries to try to fix some issues. And they're going through some hard times. And now mom is working overnights at a hotel. And anyway, I end up praying with her right there at the counter. We just prayed that God would, by his grace, help them find a way to get their kids out of the government schools and to go back to a more harmonious family situation where her daughter wasn't hanging out with these new little heathen friends from the government school. And I ended up recommending a book and recommending a website or two and had a prayer with her. And it was a pretty good experience overall. I felt like maybe I at least tried to help this poor person. And one thing I didn't do was I didn't really cut her any slack. I said, well, you've got to find a way. You've just got to find a way to get your kids out of the government schools. I hope your husband gets better. I hope his medical problems are fixed and that you can find a way. And if that means, you know, changing houses, changing cars, changing whatever, I hope you're able to find a way to get your kids out of the government school. And anyway, later on when I went outside to check the ice flow as the ice storm was closing in, she thanked me. She said she had a long conversation with her husband and she was feeling a little bit better. And I gave her my recommendations for a particular book that would help her understand the Bible better. It's called The Plot. Just Google it. You can find it. The Plot of the Bible. And made some other recommendations that I hope would help the young lady. And for all of you out there who find yourself in a situation where you simply have no choice but to send your children to the government schools, my prayer would be for you that by the grace of God, you can find a way to get your kids out before they're completely defiled and corrupted and lost. And you look back someday, you look at yourself in the mirror and you just wonder, is there something else I could have done? Because surely by the grace of God, there is something more that you could do. Let's go walk in towards paradise.
Walk in towards paradise. Walk in towards paradise. Sing, 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 sing. Walk in towards paradise.
Worldview, and I'm your host, Doug McBurney. Thank you for coming back. Someday, right? No, right now we're walking toward paradise. Oh yeah, that's what that was from the sermon this morning. What happened to a believer who died back in the old days, back in the day, as they say, before Jesus paid it all on the cross? Well, the believer who died went to paradise. Now the unbeliever, on the other hand, it was not so nice. And for all you heathens out there, the alternative today, it's not so nice either. You should be afraid. You should be very afraid. Now we go to the war on Christians. Yes, I know, you'll hear a lot this year, this season here, as we're in the Christmas season. You'll hear an awful lot about the war on Christmas. I think Bill O'Reilly does an update every night on the war on Christmas. But because he's such a Christian fellow, as he has some buxom slut in a size 6 dress hiking up her skirt talking about the war on Christmas. But we don't focus on the war on Christmas because we find that extraneous. We're concerned about the war on Christians, and Kenneth Bay is the latest victim. He's an American citizen. He was arrested in North Korea last year and was recently sentenced to 15 years of hard labor. His mother says that his Christian faith has everything to do with the reason that he's in prison in North Korea. Bae was forced to work in a North Korean labor camp for 3 months until his health deteriorated. And then he was hospitalized back in August. And now his mother is actually concerned that his hospitalization will result in an improvement in his health and he'll end up back in the labor camp. Talk about a nightmare for a mom. Worried that your son will get better because then he'll have to go back to the slave labor camp. It's terrible, terrible. Now, previous Americans detained in North Korea have been released. You remember when Bill Clinton and Jimmy Carter went on two separate missions back in 2010 to get out some, I forget, it was hikers or campers or whatever. Just your average American young person. Found themselves in a situation in North Korea, found themselves arrested. Jimmy Carter's dispatched. Bill Clinton's dispatched. Well, for whatever reason, Bae's situation has not encouraged such attention. It's been 11 months that he's been in prison,
and separated from his wife and three children? And have we heard anything out of the Obama administration or the John Kerry State Department regarding Kenneth Bay, who's being basically held hostage by a communist dictator? Have we heard anything? We haven't heard anything. These people that are being held captive, they should have a big clock next to Barry's face on the news every night, counting the days that these Americans have been in prison. I've got another one for you. Alan Gross. He's been in prison for 4 years in Cuba. He's a former U.S. government contractor. And he said in a letter recently that he feels like the government has abandoned him. And he sent that letter to President Obama. In it, he describes his isolation from the world, adding that his daughter and his mother have been stricken by cancer. His wife has had to sell the family home in Maryland. And he told the president in the letter, "My business and my career have been destroyed." Barry's response, after finishing a round of golf, Barry has sent no special emissaries, nor has he agreed to negotiate over this man held prisoner, Alan Gross. Well, his family has a new strategy. They're trying to put direct pressure on Barry. Forget the administration. Forget calling Bill Clinton or Jimmy Carter or John Kerry. They're trying to put pressure directly on Obama. Last month, a group of 66 senators signed a letter and called Gross's case a matter of grave urgency and sent that letter to Barry Obama, urging him to act on behalf of Alan Gross. And a week earlier, a separate group of 14 lawmakers signed a similar letter. The administration, in the meantime, has eased restrictions on American travel to Cuba and held direct negotiations with Cuban officials on a range of issues, but not Alan Gross's imprisonment. Captivity. Obama has indicated that he has little enthusiasm for the trade embargo and the economic sanctions that have been imposed on Cuba since Castro took over. By the way, Mr. Gross is 64 years old, and he was detained while distributing communications equipment to Jewish groups in Cuba. Aha! The Jews! He was trying to help the Jews! Mr. Gross should know that Barack Obama has no sympathy for those trying to surreptitiously help Jews anywhere. And perhaps that's part of the reason that the Barry and Kerry show have not stepped up to dispatch Bill Clinton or Dennis Rodman or whoever. And now in the meantime, speaking of the Barry and Kerry show, let's go to the war file. This is Dateline Dubai from the Reuters wire. Iran says it is moving ahead with testing more efficient uranium enrichment technology. World powers, and you'll remember now that world powers last month agreed to a deal to curb Tehran's atomic activities. So one would say, my goodness, Iran is announcing that they're testing more efficient uranium enrichment? Well, surely that's a... Didn't we just make a deal with these people? Well, the problem is the International Atomic Energy Agency has already been informed of the development, and apparently the development does not appear to contravene the agreement struck between the Barry and Kerry show and the Iranians last month. So the Iranians have some new higher-tech centrifuges, and they're installing them as fast as they can, getting them up and running. And when we find out about it, we realize that if you read the small print in the agreement we made, they're not really violating the agreement. It's all right here in the piece of paper that Mr. Kerry held up. Remember when he said peace in our time? It's very disturbing. You see, in the fine print of the Barry and Kerry agreement, Iran promised not to start operating these high-tech centrifuges, or install any more for a period of 6 months, but the agreement seems to allow Iran to continue with research and development activity, obviously in their pursuit of
peaceful nuclear energy. Very disturbed. So Iran, they're not afraid to just tell us what they're doing. I'm sure that the Iranians read the fine print in the agreement. And that's why they have that smirk on their face when they announce they have intercontinental ballistic missiles. They announced this week that they've got more advanced centrifuge technology, more advanced enrichment technology. Yes, it's all fine with Mr. Obama. Have you read the agreement? Yes, read the agreement. Mr. Obama said go right ahead. That's the war file. From there, let us move on to the nuclear winter file. I know, it's almost winter. And while I'm not predicting a nuclear winter, I am a little bit nervous about one. That's all. Listen to this. This is from the French press agency again. At a White House reception last week, President Barack Obama said that it was important for the United States to test Iran's intentions and pledged to keep working for a comprehensive deal to deprive Tehran of a nuclear weapon. Barry said, quote, "For the first time in a decade, we have halted progress of Iran's nuclear program. Key parts of the program will be rolled back, even though the toughest of our sanctions remain in place. Well, that is good for the world, and it is good for Israel," Obama said with a straight face. Obama also said that Washington must remain vigilant and that its commitment to Israeli security would remain ironclad and unshakable. He could have stopped at ironclad. He could have stopped at unshakable. But just to be sure that he bamboozles the people, he said ironclad and unshakable. And when something's ironclad and unshakable, you can be sure that somebody is bamboozling somebody. Now, Barry's critics on Capitol Hill are threatening to enact new sanctions against Iran. But Barry, and apparently this is one of the reasons that Barry chose to make these statements defending the agreement to let Iran acquire a nuclear weapon. In my opinion, that's what the agreement is. By the way, all the statements I just quoted to you from Barry were made at a Hanukkah celebration at the White House, a whole room full of Jews. And Barry's right there in your face. I tell you, this guy hates the Jews. I can just sense it from him. He hates the Jews. He hates Israel. He hates America. But that's not really new news. I'm not covering any new ground here. I apologize for digressing into something that was obvious about 6 years ago when we all noticed Barry on the periphery there chasing after Hillary. And we all thought, well, this guy, he apparently is a rabid child-killing, thieving, racist, anti-Semite, anti-Christian, anti-American, Manchurian candidate sapper who somehow slipped under the wire. I said that 6 years ago. So I apologize for digressing into fairly obvious grounds. But I do want to point out that Barry is right in the Jew's face, right in front of him. No need to be discreet anymore. No need for him to be discreet and to try to hide any of his intentions anymore. Everybody knows exactly what he is. Everybody knows exactly what he's up to. And the scary thing is that a majority of people, I think, support him in what he is and what he does. The lying, the thieving, the murdering, the anti-Semitism, the anti-Americanism, the racism. I think he's managed to isolate enough little pockets of support so that if he doesn't have a majority of the people on his side, at least worldwide he has a plurality of the people on his side. And that's all a dictator needs is a plurality. And I can assure you Barry has his sights set on something much bigger than being the president of the United States. Barry has his sights set on world domination of his particular worldview, world propagation of his particular worldview, which is no friend of the Jews, which is no friend of Jesus Christ, and is no friend of the Creator God Almighty, and he's certainly no friend of yours and mine. First things first, we're gonna change the rules. Better listen up, all you boys and girls. Your prayer says there'll be no after school. So vote for me, now wouldn't that be cool? Yeah, 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 yeah. And now I know there's trouble in the Middle East. I spend all my money when I stop the arms race. All my brothers in the desert gonna have themselves a feast. When that's gone, then we'll start a world peace. Yeah. It's the Weekly Worldview. All right, boys, that's just about enough of that. Internationalist guitar player Nuno Bettencourt. Suspicious of that guy. He doesn't have an American name. Where's that boy from? Nuno. What's that now?
Where's that
prison? Oh, yeah, where's Barry from? Well, that's an open question. I know where he's coming from, but I don't know where he's from. All right, now, to buttress the point that I just made, we go to the economics file, where the Wall Street Journal reports that households from the United States and Europe and Japan may soon face fiscal shocks worse than any market crash. Yeah. Billionaire investor Bill Gross is talking about higher taxes. And why should you care what Bill Gross is talking about? Well, Bill Gross has a plan, and he's a powerful fellow. He wants to ask, he says, he wants to ask people he calls the Scrooge McDucks of the world to accept higher personal income taxes. The IMF's latest fiscal monitor report argues that taxing the wealthy offers a significant revenue potential at relatively low efficiency costs. So that means billionaire investor Bill Gross and the International Monetary Fund think they might finally be in a position to tax the rich and just take as much money as they possibly can. Because, you see, the world's in a bit of an economic crisis. I know that there are those propagating the idea that we're in some kind of economic recovery. But anyone with half a brain knows that we're teetering on the brink of economic catastrophe. And all folks like billionaire investor Bill Gross and the IMF need to do is just let a little bit of this stuff start happening and let civilization and the economic order start to teeter and crack, and they'll be in a fine position to come in and tax the rich. Now, the IMF has been thinking about this, as you can well imagine, and they calculate that the average revenue maximizing rate is about 60%. 60%, they said. Now, the IMF singles out the United States as a country where raising top rates towards 70%, which the Wall Street Journal reminds us that's where tax rates were before the Reagan tax cuts. You remember how good things were going before the Reagan tax cuts? You remember how wonderful everything was? Does anybody remember? Yeah, we were in the toilet. Things were awful, terrible, depressing, in a downward economic spiral. It was the Reagan tax cuts that actually prevented the collapse of the economic order in the early 1980s, in my opinion. But the IMF seems to think those rates were fine. They were up around 70% for top earners. And the IMF says that if we took tax rates back to that level for the rich, well, that would yield the most revenue. And with chilling candor, the Wall Street Journal reports, with chilling candor, the IMF admits that its revenue-maximizing approach takes no account of the well-being of the wage earners or their businesses. So they're not really concerned about how this affects the person from whom they steal the money, as quite often thieves simply aren't concerned about the effects of their thievery on the victim. That's the last thing on their mind. What they're really thinking about is getting the money. That's really common in thief speak. Well, back in October, the IMF floated a bold idea that didn't get the attention it deserved, according to the Wall Street Journal, lowering sovereign debt levels through a one-off tax on private wealth. Yes, they say that a 10% levy on households' net positive net worth would bring public debt levels back to pre-financial crisis levels. And we all remember how good those levels were, right? The levels of national indebtedness before the crisis, they were so good that they led to an international crisis. And that's what the IMF wants to bring us back to by a one-time tax on what they call rich people, which means every household in the United States of America who makes more than about 12 grand a year. They're considered rich by the IMF. By the way, all you Obama supporters who got your Obama phone and you think none of this can affect you, well, the IMF thinks you're rich because everywhere else in the world, you are rich. Now, the Wall Street Journal says that such a tax sounds crazy, a 10% levy on all households. But recall what happened in Eurozone country Cyprus this year, earlier this year. Bank accounts
larger than 100,000 euros had to incur losses of up to 100% of their savings above that 100,000 euro threshold. They just came in and took all their money over in Cyprus. We reported on that. We found that quite disturbing. Now, Japan, by the way, is, according to the IMF, Japan is sitting on one of the world's largest pools of savings. And so guess what, all you folks over there in Japan, right? You love to watch CNN International on TV? Well, guess what? They know that you have all this savings under your bed. And the Wall Street Journal reports that 240% of GDP, the Japanese public debt ratio, is more than twice that of Cyprus when it defaulted. And guess what? They got away with it in Cyprus. So all of you Japanese with the money under your bed, well, look out. Let's see. The Wall Street Journal concludes that powerful economic players are deciding that with an ever-deteriorating global financial outlook, weapons of mass wealth destruction, such as the IMF's one-off capital levy, Cyprus bank deposit confiscation, or outright sovereign defaults are likelier by the day. Powerful economic players. Do you think it's powerful economic players that are deciding this? I think it's socialist governments, which means lying, murderous thieves. They'll lie to you first, they'll kill who they have to, and then they'll steal what you got. And that's what we're headed to. Forget the economic recovery. When things start to crack, these socialist governments, the United States included, foremost amongst them, they're going to come for the private savings of folks like you and me, frankly. And then things are going to get very ugly, folks. Because the lying and the murdering, we seem to be able to tolerate. But when they start coming after our money, Americans tend to start picking up guns and shooting at people. They draw the line at stealing our money. I don't know why. If we would draw the line at lying and murder, we probably would never have to get to the point where we have to argue about you stealing our money. I don't understand you people. I choose to draw the line at the lying and the murdering, frankly. And then the money will take care of itself. But it seems like we're past all that. All right, now the world, we're running out of time. And I don't mean that in an apocalyptic sense. I mean the show, we're running out of time. But the world is mourning Nelson Mandela, who died at the age of 95. Now, before I go into the story I'm about to cover, I do want to give credit where credit is due. I will be the first to give credit to Nelson Mandela for calling upon his fellow citizens not to execute vengeance upon the apartheid rulers and plunge the country into immediate civil war and chaos and violence and bloodshed. I think you have to admit that Mandela did that. All right? But he did other things too, okay? In fact, the Herald Scotland reports that Nelson Mandela called for the man convicted of the Lockerbie bombing to be released from his Glasgow prison cell as he felt the Libyan terrorist bomber had suffered an injustice. You remember Ali Mohammed Ali Magrahi? You remember he was released from prison claiming that he was dying of cancer? And then he went and lived in Libya in the lap of luxury for months or years. Did he ever die? I think he finally died. Anyway, Mandela visited Megrahi in the Scottish prison in 2002. Megrahi, you'll remember, was convicted in the December 1988 bombing of the Pan Am jet over Lockerbie, Scotland that claimed the lives of 270 innocent people. And Mandela went to visit him in jail. What was Mandela upset about? Mandela described Megrahi's solitary confinement as nothing short of psychological persecution and called for him to be released from prison. Here's what Mandela said. Here's Mandela's perspective on prison and solitary confinement. Mandela said, "I profited a great deal by serving my sentence with other people. Our minds were occupied every day by something positive. For that reason, it's difficult for me to believe that I was in jail for 27 years." Unquote.
Well, I agree, to release him.
You agree to release Megrahi? You agree?
Yeah.
I find that shocking.
And then execute.
Oh, I see. He should be released out of the jail, out of the building,
and walked across, stood up against the wall, and shot. Okay.
I mean, just be done.
Hung? You prefer hang?
Whatever.
Oh, you're okay with whatever? Okay. I thought maybe we were going to get in an argument about how he should be killed.
No, no.
But okay, I'll go with that theory of release. But as far as... Now, what I want to talk through with Mr. Mandela's perspective on prison is, number one, Mandela was convicted of terrorist acts and plotting the violent overthrow of the government. Okay, let's keep that in mind. Now, I know a lot of people have been saying, well, you know, when Mandela was young, he was a socialist. Yes, he might have plotted some terrorist act. He may have participated in some violence. But as he got older, he mellowed and he became such a statesman. Well, first of all, that's not true, because up until the day he died, Mandela was standing up on behalf of socialists and murderers. He called for the release of this particular terrorist. He also famously said that we will never truly be free until our brothers in Palestine are liberated. Remember that? Yeah, he called up until the day he died. That's the way he felt. And when he talks about this in prison, that he spent time with other people, and it was difficult for him to even believe that he was in jail for 27 years. To me, that's an indictment of prison itself. Because if you allow anyone to live in prison when they should have been executed, like Mandela should have been executed when he was convicted of being a terrorist and an advocate for the violent overthrow of the government, for those crimes, anyone convicted should be executed. But instead, Mandela was allowed to live a relatively happy life in prison. He was allowed to think and speak and write and interact and influence people and bamboozle the whole world into thinking that now he was some great statesman. And just because he chose not to have F.W. de Klerk beheaded in the public square, you know, we say he's a great statesman. I say that Mandela was a very flawed politician, a terrorist, and a socialist who did a couple of good things along the way. That's the way I classify Mandela, and I'm not really mourning him, and the flag here at the McBurney compound was not lowered to half-staff for Mandela. That's all. All right. Now, from the Bad Religion file, we're really running out of time now. A small but growing movement by Jewish activists is demanding the right to pray at the site of their destroyed temple. Shocking. Jews want to pray on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, but right now the Muslims ban Jews from any public worship there. Yeah. So I got a problem with any religion that bans Jews from anything. Now, I do not have a problem with banning Muslims. Okay, so I'll admit that I'm biased right up front, but I have a problem with any religion or any group that calls for the banning of Jews. What do the Muslims have to say about this? Well, they're outraged. Sheikh Azam al-Khatib, the director of the Islamic Trust that administers the Temple Mount, says that this place belongs to the Muslim people and no others have the right to pray here. If they try to take over the mosque, this will be the end of time, the Muslim fanatic warned. He says this will create rage and anger not only in the West, not only in the West Bank, but all over the Islamic world, and God only knows what will happen. No, Mohammed, God's not the only one who knows what will happen. We all know what will happen. Yeah, if the Jews decide to pray there and you guys decide to declare war against the Jews, we know what will happen. The Jews will destroy your savage armies. You know, they'll beat you back inside the gates of your hellhole communities and cities. They'll destroy your armies, your tanks, your planes, your young men. They'll bomb you back into the Stone Age. And then for the rest of all time immemorial, the whole world will have to struggle with the fact that you decided to make wars on the Jews again, and they destroyed you again, and now we all feel guilty, and then I guess we start all over again. We know what will happen, Mohammed Sheikh Azam al-Khatib. It's a shame that the Muslims are in charge of the Temple Mount, in my opinion. All right. Now, we're really out of time. I'm going to save this for Bob Enyart's show. And we're going to move instead right to the politics file. I'll set these stories aside. I'll be on Bob Enyart's show all week this week. Should be an interesting time. You can listen on KLTT AM 670 radio in Denver, or you can catch us on the podcast at KGOV.com. But let's go to the Let's go to the politics file from the LA Times. Energy officials worry a lot these days about the stability of the massive patchwork of wires, substations, and algorithms that keeps electricity flowing in America. Several scenarios could lead to a collapse of the American power grid. A well-executed cyber attack, a freak storm, sabotage. And now, renewable energy adds unprecedented levels of stress to our electricity grid. Green energy is the least predictable kind of energy, and it's delivered to the grid in an unpredictable way. Why? Well, because nobody can say for certain when the wind will blow or when the sun will shine. It's interesting to hear liberals admit that. They can't. Anyway, what happens here? A field of solar panels could be cranking out huge amounts of energy 1 minute and then a tiny amount the next when a cloud goes over. Same thing with your wind turbines. The wind's blowing massive amounts of energy. Suddenly the wind stops. Now there's no energy. Well, this is not good for the grid. Concerned state and federal officials are spending billions of dollars in an effort to hasten the technological breakthroughs needed for the grid to keep up with the demands of so-called clean energy. The California Public Utilities Commission last month ordered large power companies to invest heavily in efforts to develop storage technologies. And that means that, well, what does that mean? Well, while the question of whether those technologies will ever be economically viable on a large scale is still hotly debated, the one guarantee is that ratepayers are already spending an awful lot of money on these investments being ordered by the likes of the state of California. And the only guarantee is that ratepayers will be spending a lot. Meanwhile, power grid operators in some states have had to dump energy produced by wind turbines on windy days because regional power systems had no place to put the electricity. Officials say that we're getting to the point where we may have to pay people not to produce power. That's according to the mayor of Long Beach, and that's the perfect political scenario for any good liberal, paying people not to do things. It fits right in with their whole worldview. And this has been my worldview, and we're out of time. Should the Lord tarry, I'll return next week. And until then, I want to thank my friends at KGOV.com, TheologyOnline.com, AmericanRightToLife.com, and as always, my other brother Darryl, who makes it all happen here in the Weekly Worldview Studios. Until I return, may the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.